Well, some of you may dimly remember that several years ago we did have a short Sunday evening series looking at David's infamous moral collapse that's documented for us in 2 Samuel 11 and 12, and I suppose in a slightly different way in Psalm 51. And although this evening then we're going to be in the same biblical territory as then, I want to approach this from a different angle. The heading that we have in our ESVs above, 2 Samuel 11, while understandable, is, it seems to me, a little misleading, this heading, David and Bathsheba. I think it should rather be David and Uriah. For one thing, it only takes a cursory glance at this passage to appreciate that the other name, in addition to David's, which dominates the passage, isn't Bathsheba's name, it's Uriah's name. This passage is not a graphic account of that night of passion between David and Bathsheba. That, in fact, is relegated to a single verse in the chapter. It's virtually all about David's increasingly desperate quest to deal with Uriah. And then for another thing, when you go to the next chapter, to chapter 12, and Nathan visiting David and confronting David with his wrongdoing, the emphasis there in Nathan's message to David is not on what he has done with Bathsheba, it's on what he has done to Uriah. Verse 9 particularly captures that. Verse 9 of chapter 12. Why have you despised the word of the Lord to do what is evil in his sight? You have struck down Uriah the Hittite with the sword and have taken his wife to be your wife and have killed him with the sword of the Ammonites. And so I'm saying then that Uriah is more prominent in this whole episode than that heading certainly indicates, and I think than we often recognize. And having established then Uriah's prominence here, I now want to make a further suggestion, which is this, that Uriah in this passage is being contrasted with someone else, someone we might not naturally think of in connection with Uriah. When we're reading the Bible, I think we very easily erect in our minds lots of very fixed boundaries, as though the Bible kind of comprises a collection of discrete, independent literary units. And even when we're reading a single book of the Bible, we can easily fall into that mindset. And so when it comes to Samuel then, we can think like this. Well, Uriah's appearance in 2 Samuel, it's here in chapters 11 and 12, and that's where Uriah belongs, and he has nothing to do with anything else outside of 2 Samuel 11 and 12. And yes, okay, there might be some things after chapters 11 and 12, which are kind of consequentially related to Uriah's appearance. But certainly, we would not expect Uriah's appearance to be related to anything that comes before chapters 11 and 12. But we shouldn't erect those very fixed boundaries. And two chapters earlier then, in 2 Samuel chapter 9, we encounter another character. It's Mephibosheth. And I want to suggest to you this evening that Uriah is deliberately being contrasted with this other character two chapters earlier, Mephibosheth. Now, I'm not saying that that contrast is the great key to 2 Samuel chapter 11, and if you've never spotted it before, then you've been barking up the wrong tree every time you've ever read 2 Samuel 11. I'm not saying that, but I am saying it's one dimension to this passage. I mean, biblical narrators are sophisticated, and they are often then doing several different things in any given narrative. And I'm saying then this is one thread amongst others, which this narrator is weaving into this story. To be unaware of it is not a terrible tragedy by any means. But nonetheless, to be aware of it is, in my opinion, enriching as we look at 2 Samuel 11. And so I have then this evening three headings. And first of all, a genuine contrast. A genuine contrast. Because if we're saying then that Uriah is here being contrasted with Mephibosheth, that this is a deliberate thing the narrator is doing, we have to have pretty good grounds, don't we, for making a claim like that. I mean, we can't just kind of open the Bible randomly and come across any old character with a funny name and say, oh, I think that Uriah has been contrasted with this guy here. No, that there must be connections. There must be parallels between the two characters which make it tenable and make it reasonable for us to make this kind of a claim. Many English literature students over the years have contrasted the character Hamlet with the character Macbeth. The ways in which psychologically and arguably morally they are such different cases. But of course that contrast is only possible because both Hamlet and Macbeth are heroes in Shakespearean tragedies, because they both kill the king, because they both have encounters with ghosts, and so we could go on. I suppose I'm saying there have to be points of comparison in order for there to be points of contrast. And there are then points of comparison between Mephibosheth and Uriah. Now, I didn't read chapter 9 in our service this evening. I was a bit worried that if I read both the passages, you would already have the sermon mapped out before I even began it. But some of you will know that passage well enough anyway, and even if you don't, it's a fairly straightforward passage, and hopefully you'll pick up its gist as we make some comments on it. So let's just have a look then at some points of comparison between these two characters. And first of all, at the most general level, in terms of their ethnic or familial roots, there is perhaps a comparison. They are both what we might call throwbacks. They are both survivors of a people or a family which had once possessed power and status, but which lost that power and status to such an extent it's actually amazing there are any survivors at all. So Uriah then, he's a Hittite. That's what we are repeatedly told about Uriah. He's a Hittite. Now, who are the Hittites? Well, the Hittites are one of those people groups which possessed the land of Canaan before the Israelites ever turned up on the scene. You may remember that the first legal possession of any of Canaan by an Israelite was when Abraham purchased from a Hittite that burial plot for his wife Sarah. And so they then, in fact, that there had been quite, the history books tell us, there had been quite a substantial Hittite empire, and they then had been settled there in the land of Canaan for many centuries. They had had power and status, but then, of course, the Israelites had come along. And they had come along with that divine command that you are to wipe out all the nations that presently live in Canaan, including the Hittites. The Hittites are always specifically mentioned in that list of the nations the Israelites were to wipe out. And so, as I say then, Uriah here is kind of an unlikely survivor. Here he is, and he's a member of this race, this ethnic group that wasn't actually supposed to be anymore. Mephibosheth, on the other hand, well, he, of course, hails from the house of Saul. He's Saul's grandson. And that, of course, had been the ruling family in Israel. And so they'd had power and status. But then, of course, the house of Saul had been superseded by the house of David. Now listen to Deraf Davis, the Old Testament scholar. He writes this. He says, when a new regime or dynasty came to power, the name of the game, he's talking about in the ancient world generally, the name of the game was purge. The new king always needed to solidify his position. It was conventional political policy, solidification by liquidation. In other words, the members of an old ruling family didn't normally get allowed to just continue living their lives as if nothing had happened, in the way that Mephibosheth is here. Normally they were wiped out. If you belonged to that family that used to rule, you were wiped out by the new regime. And so Mephibosheth, like Uriah, he's an unlikely survivor. And so I'm saying that that is just one very precursory general comparison. But then moving on into the narratives themselves, but remaining at a very basic level, both are men then with whom David has dealings. Of course, David's reign is the focus of this book of 2 Samuel. The narrator's concern is with documenting David's career. And so it's only because these two men feature within that reign, within that career, that we know of them, that history has remembered them at all. But again, it's a basic comparison that these are both men with whom David has dealings. But then getting into the more specific details of the narratives, David's dealings with these men, in both cases, are based upon a prior relationship with someone else. So his dealings with Mephibosheth are based on his prior relationship with Jonathan, Mephibosheth's father. If it weren't for that prior relationship, then what transpires between David and Mephibosheth in chapter 9 there wouldn't have transpired. And his dealings then with Uriah, they of course are based on his prior relationship with Uriah's wife, Bathsheba. And if it weren't for that prior relationship, then the events that transpire between David and Uriah in chapter 11 would not have transpired. And then getting a bit more specific still, both these men are invited by David to dine in his presence. So with Uriah, it's there in chapter 11, verse 13. David invited him, and he ate in his presence and drank. With Mephibosheth, it's mentioned in chapter 9, verse 7. The end of verse 7 there, David says to Mephibosheth, "You shall eat at my table always." It's quite a repeated emphasis, actually. It's mentioned again in verse 10 and in verse 11 and in verse 13. So that's a quite specific comparison. Then again, in both cases, David approaches these men through an intermediary. So in the case of Mephibosheth, he approaches him through this other man, Ziba. And Ziba is a very natural intermediary for David to choose, because he was one of Saul's servants when Saul was still alive, and so he has this close connection with the family, the house of Saul. So he's an obvious intermediary. In the case of Uriah, of course, Joab is the intermediary through whom David approaches Uriah. And again, that's very natural, because Joab, of course, is the commander of David's army, and Uriah is a soldier within David's army, and so he's under Joab's command. In fact, in both cases, in both these passages, we have two separate approaches of David through the intermediary. So in chapter 9, he approaches Ziba twice. Verse 2, "Now there was a servant of the house of Saul whose name was Ziba, and they called him to David." So that's approach number 1. Then approach number 2 is in verse 9. "Then the king called Ziba, Saul's servant, and said to him," In chapter 11, similarly, he approaches Joab twice. First time is in verse 6. "David sent word to Joab, 'Send me Uriah the Hittite.'" And then the second approach is in verse 14. "David wrote a letter to Joab." And so that's another detailed comparison. And then finally, there's quite a bit of vocabulary that is common to both these narratives. Feet. Of course, that's the most famous thing about Mephibosheth, isn't it? That he had this disability in his feet. Of course, there's a very sad reason for that. When he was 5 years old, his father and grandfather were killed on the battlefield. And you remember how on hearing the news of that, Mephibosheth's nurse picks up the boy in order to flee, presumably fearing that the Philistines, having killed Saul and Jonathan, will come after the rest of the family next. And as she's fleeing, she drops Mephibosheth, and it's that accident that causes this injury that lasts the whole of his life. So feet are mentioned a couple of times in chapter 9, and then in chapter 11, interestingly, in verse 8, David says to Uriah, "Go down to your house and wash your feet." House is another word. It's used 7 times in chapter 9. There aren't many verses in chapter 9. There are only 13, but house is mentioned 7 times. In chapter 11, verses 1 to 21, it's mentioned 10 times. Both men are referred to as David's servant. Mephibosheth calls himself that in verses 6 and verse 8 of chapter 9. And Joab describes Uriah as David's servant in chapter 11, verse 21. And both are described as dead. In Uriah's case, Joab describes him as literally dead once he has been killed. And Mephibosheth, he introduces himself to David in verse 8 of chapter 9 as a dead dog. Perhaps referring then to his disability and to the fact he belongs to this kind of bygone dynasty. So I hope you can see then that there are these points of comparison between these two narratives, which it seemed to me provide the necessary basis for a genuine contrast to exist. So that's the first thing then, a genuine contrast. But then secondly, a grim contrast. A grim contrast. So Uriah is being contrasted with Mephibosheth. And I want to show now then that it's a grim contrast. And again, we can break this down into several aspects. So first of all then, we said a moment ago that David's dealings with these men, in both cases, they are based on a prior relationship with someone else. And that is true. But whereas, of course, in Mephibosheth's case, David's prior relationship with Jonathan is a beautiful relationship centered on loyalty. In Uriah's case, David's prior relationship with Bathsheba is an ugly relationship centered on lust. Whereas David's relationship with Jonathan is about promises and commitment, his relationship with Bathsheba is casual and reckless. Whereas to Jonathan, he gives all those assurances, doesn't he, about the future and how he will provide for Jonathan's children. With Bathsheba, there's no thought in David's mind for anything beyond this moment and instant gratification for his sexual cravings. In short, whereas the Jonathan relationship, which lies behind his dealings with Mephibosheth, is a covenantal relationship, the Bathsheba relationship, which lies behind his dealings with Uriah, is the opposite. An irresponsible one-night stand. In fact, it's not only uncovenantal in the sense that it's devoid of any commitment, it's actually anti-covenantal, isn't it? In that it's a direct assault on the covenant that does exist between Bathsheba and her husband Uriah. So that's one aspect of this grim contrast. Then for another thing, I said that both these men are invited by David to dine in his presence. And again, that's true. But whereas in Mephibosheth's case, it's a sincere invitation because David wants to bless and honor this man by bringing him to his table, in Uriah's case, it's an insincere invitation. It's because he wants to intoxicate this man at his table. You see, he needs Uriah to go and sleep with his wife Bathsheba, doesn't he? So that once the pregnancy becomes known, there'll be no awkward questions, there'll be no suspicions. No one will query Uriah's paternity. Ah, yes, everyone will say, we remember that Uriah, he did come back from the war for a night or two, and he did go and spend that time at home with his own wife, and so that must have been when this child was conceived. But the problem for David is that Uriah won't go and sleep with Bathsheba, his wife. He's too conscious, isn't he, of his fellow soldiers. And the fact then that they're experiencing such privations out there on the battlefield. And it just doesn't seem right to Uriah for him to be enjoying himself back home in Jerusalem while his comrades are out there in those conditions. And so David needs to somehow try and break down those scruples. And he thinks that alcohol might be the best way of doing it. So whereas his desire for Mephibosheth is that Mephibosheth should enjoy good food and drink at the royal table and should feel valued and loved by being afforded that privilege, his desire for Uriah is simply that he should get drunk as quickly as possible at his table, so that he'll then, his conduct will then be directed more by his bodily urges than by his conscientious principles. But then for another thing, we said that in both cases, David approaches these men through an intermediary. Ziba in one case, Joab in the other. And again, that's true. But whereas in Mephibosheth's case, David's command to Ziba goes like this, chapter 9, verse 10. You and your sons and your servants shall till the land for Mephibosheth and shall bring in the produce. David's command to Joab about Uriah goes like this, chapter 11, verse 15. Set Uriah in the forefront of the hardest fighting and then draw back from him so that he may be struck down and die. You see, David's intoxication strategy had been unsuccessful. Even in his inebriated state, Uriah had kept to his principles and maintained his sexual abstinence. And so David now has to develop a new approach. And so if he couldn't create the impression that the child is Uriah's, he now has to create the impression that the child is his own, but legitimately so. And so he has to remove Uriah and marry Bathsheba so quickly that the timescale will look about right and this child will be regarded as a honeymoon baby. So whereas Ziba is to carefully bring in the crops for Mephibosheth, Joab is to recklessly throw away Uriah's life. That's the contrast. Ziba, of course, will in fact later on betray Mephibosheth, won't he? Some of you who know 2 Samuel will be aware of that, how later on in the context of Absalom's conspiracy, Ziba will betray Mephibosheth. But he won't do that with David's approval. Joab, on the other hand, is actually ordered by David to betray Uriah, to act against all his instincts as an army commander and put one of his own soldiers in a place of mortal danger, needlessly. So that's another aspect of this grim contrast. And then just one more thing here. We're told something interesting about Mephibosheth in chapter 9, verse 12. In chapter 9, verse 12, we're told that Mephibosheth had a young son whose name was Micah. Why are we told that? What's the significance of that detail? What's the big deal about this child? Well, I think the big deal about this child is that this child could create serious problems for David's kingship. Remember, this is the house of Saul we're talking about. The one family in Israel that might feel it had a legitimate claim on the throne. And okay, Mephibosheth is unlikely ever to be a threat to David. He's a pathetic character with this rather pronounced physical disability. But Micah, he's a different kettle of fish. There's nothing to stop him one day attempting a coup. So this child could cause serious problems for David's kingship, which puts him in a rather similar category to this other child who's conceived in Bathsheba's womb in chapter 11, verse 5. This child too could create serious problems for David's kingship, albeit in a different way. This child, he could ruined David's reputation just by his very existence. He graphically exposes David's lust and David's lack of self-control. This child, by his very existence, calls into question David's moral qualification to be on the throne. So I'm saying with these two children, chapter 9 and chapter 11, both of whom could create serious problems for David's kingship. But whereas in the first case, David is jolly well going to make sure he does the right thing toward Mephibosheth, even if it does mean there's a child who could one day ruin him. In the second case, David will jolly well make sure that the child cannot one day ruin him, even if it means doing the wrong thing towards Uriah. So I hope you can see then that Uriah is being contrasted with Mephibosheth, and it's a grim contrast. I've used this word whereas a lot in the last few minutes, and all those whereases have pointed in exactly the same direction. We could sum up, whereas in his dealings with Mephibosheth, David is very good. In his dealings with Uriah, David is very bad. You may have noticed on the wall behind me this morning and this evening that the title I have given to this evening's sermon then is, Are You Safe in David's Hands? Are you safe in David's hands? That's my question. If you're an Israelite citizen, around 1000 BC, when this man is on the throne of Israel, are you safe? Are you safe in David's hands? Is this king conducive to your health and safety and welfare? And I suppose we instinctively probably answer that question with a resounding yes. We're talking about David here. You know how in the United States they regularly have these polls to rank all their different presidents that they've had over the centuries. And apparently then the recurring top three are Abraham Lincoln, George Washington, and Franklin Roosevelt. And I guess for most of us then, if we were ranking Old Testament kings, David would be our Abraham Lincoln. He would be top, wouldn't he? We would happily live under David's kingship, we would say. Instinctively, we feel that. But of course, in the light of what we've considered this evening, the real answer to my question, are you safe in David's hands? The real answer is this. It depends. It depends. If you're Mephibosheth, then yes, certainly, you're safe in David's hands. If you're Mephibosheth, then David's kingship means unconditional protection and security. For you, David is a hero who has your very best interests at heart, always. And of course, it's not just for Mephibosheth that that's true. It's interesting that in between these two chapters we're looking at, we have chapter 10, of course. And in chapter 10, we encounter some more Israelite citizens who also receive first-class treatment from King David. We have a bunch of royal officials who are sent by David on royal business to the land of Ammon. But there in Ammon, you'll perhaps know the story, they are misunderstood and they are humiliated. They are stripped naked from the waist down. And they have their beards half shaven off. And in that sorry state, utterly mortified, they are sent packing. And David then, on hearing this, he doesn't send a text message to his Ammonite counterpart saying, LOL. Great practical joke, my friend. He doesn't say anything like that. No, having heard the news, he does two things. Number one, he thoughtfully arranges for these humiliated men to have asylum somewhere where their beards can grow back before they return to the city of Jerusalem. And number two, he mobilizes his troops to attack the land of Ammon. Think of the impact of that on those royal officials. Wow. David cares so much about a dishonor done to us that he's mobilizing the army to go and attack the Ammonites. Our reputations and our dignity is that important to King David. How wonderful. And so I'm saying, if you're Mephibosheth, or if you're those servants in chapter 10, then yes, certainly you're safe in David's hands, all right. But if you're Uriah, it's a different story altogether, isn't it? If you're Uriah, then you're anything but safe in David's hands. For Uriah, David's kingship is something sinister and toxic and ruinous. For Uriah, David is an evil menace who's bent on his destruction. For Uriah, the man to whom he should be able to look for protection from life's threats, for Uriah, instead, he is the greatest of all life's threats. So are you safe in David's hands? Or you might be, or you might not be. It's a lottery. Being a subject of this king might turn out a dream come true, or it might turn out your worst possible nightmare. This king might act for you, championing your cause, but then again, he might suddenly turn on you in a surge of implacable hostility. You might be lucky, like Mephibosheth. You might be unlucky, like Uriah. At the end of the day, we can't say anything more than that in answer to this question. But now we're ready then to move to our third and final heading. It's a genuine contrast, it's a grim contrast, but thirdly, it's a gospel contrast. A gospel contrast. How can it be, you might wonder? In light of what we've just been saying, it's a grim contrast. How can this also then be a gospel contrast? Well, because sometimes we need to find ourselves disappointed with King David. We've focused this evening on this contrast between chapters 9 and 11. I love the contrast that we have between chapters 9 and 8. It's a much happier contrast. In chapter 8, we have David having kind of become established in Jerusalem, having made that proposal that we touched on this morning to Nathan, and having received Nathan's response. In chapter 8, we have this list of David's victories. That's the ESV heading, and it's a very appropriate heading in this case. And there's a refrain, actually, in chapter 8. It's there in verse 6, "The Lord gave victory to David wherever he went." And it's there again in verse 14, "The Lord gave victory to David wherever he went." And so David in chapter 8 is depicted as this mighty conqueror. But then, of course, in chapter 9, as we've seen already this evening, we have a different side of David coming across. His gentleness toward this pathetic dead dog, Mephibosheth, and the way in which he's so tender and so faithful and invites this man to his own table and all the rest of it. And it's a wonderful contrast then, both David the mighty conqueror and David the tender, gentle king. And in that contrast, don't we see Jesus so clearly, in that two-sidedness? We looked a year ago at the emotional life of Jesus, and we often went to John 11, Jesus at Bethany there. And you have such a wonderful juxtaposition of emotions there. On the one hand, he's angry. He's outraged, John says. He snorts like a horse. With whom is he angry? He's angry surely with Satan, with the one who stands behind this death that has happened. But he's not just angry, is he? He's also so tender to Mary and Martha. He weeps with them. And it's the same then, wonderful two-sidedness. Jesus, the mighty conqueror who defeats our enemies, but Jesus, the gentle one, who invites us to his table, even though we're dead dogs, the lot of us. But the problem is then, if it was like that on page after page of 2 Samuel, if just on every page David was so wonderfully exemplary, then we might get to a point where we think we don't need Jesus at all. And so we need this contrast that we have here. between chapters 9 and 11, we need to face up to this question: are you safe in David's hands? We need a healthy disappointment with David to kick in at some point in order to drive us to David's greater descendant, Jesus. Because, of course, the wonderful thing then about Jesus is that the answer to the question, when applied to him, is always yes. Are you safe in Jesus' hands? Of course, I mean, if you're a subject of King Jesus. We're talking about subjects of King David, both Mephibosheth and Uriah. They were both loyal within the kingdom of David. And that's what we're talking about with Jesus. Of course, if you're an enemy of Jesus, if you don't bow to him as king, then you're not safe. But if you're a subject of King Jesus, if you've come under his kingly authority, then the answer is always yes. Are you safe in Jesus' hands? Yes. Yes. Perhaps you need reminding of that this evening. Perhaps you've had the experience in life of people you thought were safe turning out not to be safe at all. Perhaps a school teacher. Perhaps a parent. Perhaps a spouse. Perhaps a Christian minister. And you trusted that person, and that person turned out to be unsafe and to be ruinous, or certainly potentially ruinous to you. And it shakes your confidence in everyone. And I'm saying then, you're safe in Jesus' hands. He will never turn on you. He will never fail you. He will never let you down. He will never prove volatile. There'll be no 2 Samuel 11 eruptions with Jesus. We're going to sing in just a couple of minutes a paraphrase of Psalm 72. I love Psalm 72, and particularly one verse in it. Psalm 72 is a messianic psalm, very clearly. It's speaking of the Lord Jesus. And in verse 14, it says this: from oppression and violence, he, that's this king who's coming, he redeems their life. And then this: and precious is their blood in his sight. Precious is his people's blood in his sight. It's the opposite of David, isn't it? Here, that awful phrase he comes out with in verse 25 in his response to Joab. Oh, the sword devours now one and now another. Oh, well, someone's been killed. You win some, you lose some. My soldiers are dispensable. Uriah, well, he's gone. Not to worry. And here's Jesus, Psalm 72 is saying, and the blood of his people is precious in his sight. Jesus will never be so concerned with his own career that he'll get rid of you, in the way that David was so concerned with his own career that he got rid of Uriah. With Jesus, it's the opposite, of course. He was so concerned with you that he got rid of himself. And he threw his own life away on a cross 2,000 years ago. Then dawned at last that day of dread, when desolate and undismayed, with wearied frame and thorn-crowned head, he now, forsaken and betrayed, went up for me to Calvary, and dying there in grief and shame, he saved me. Blessed be his name. He never writes a letter of the cynical kind that David writes there in verse 14. Isn't that such a cynical move? Making Uriah the postman of his own death warrant. Giving Uriah a letter, and Uriah doesn't know what's in there. And the letter says, kill Uriah. Jesus never writes a letter saying, get rid of this person of mine. Get rid of this person. It's the opposite. This very night, he pleads for you and for me at God's right hand. Forgive them. I've died for them. Forgive their sins. Wash them clean, Father. Look upon them favorably. You are safe in the hands of King Jesus. Be encouraged. Trust him. And if you're not a Christian tonight, don't you want a master like this one? Don't you want a king like Jesus? Come to Jesus Christ and bow to him as your king. Amen.